The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Marinda Magelli is titled, Why Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's Locks Are About More Than Just Hair. While listening to President Biden acknowledge Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's daughter, Layla, at the announcement of her nomination, I was suddenly overcome with emotion about what this nomination meant for my own 5-month-old daughter with the same name. If Judge Jackson is confirmed, my daughter won't experience reality where the highest court in the country never had a justice that looked like her. I recognize the real-life consequences of her confirmation, particularly given that we are at a critical time in the nation's legal history. I am scared to think of a future for my daughter where Roe v. Wade is overturned. Supreme Court decisions on health care, voting rights, and abortion access will impact my daughter, my son, and countless young people for generations to come. But I also see the symbolic importance and feel inspired by KBJ's nomination. Yes, it matters that Judge Jackson is a Black woman and her hair holds significant importance. While many women take for granted that the hair growing from their heads won't be viewed as problematic, Black women and girls do not always have this luxury. In my lifetime, natural hair has been considered unprofessional, unattractive, and unkempt. As a Black woman, I know all too well the mental calculus I have to do when it comes to how I choose to wear my hair. It's an exhausting, additional burden Black women have to consider that our white counterparts don't. The year I graduated from law school in 2007, female lawyers at Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton were counseled that natural hair was a no-go in the workplace. This incident was widely discussed within my network, and even though I worked in the public sector instead of at a white shoe law firm, it affirmed my feeling that I needed to look the part. I straightened my hair for the interview at the public defender's office, and as an attorney there, felt pressure to do so before court appearances. When I started, twice I was confused for a client, not a lawyer, despite the fact that I always dressed in a suit and clients were almost always dressed casually. I didn't want my clients to be penalized if others saw me as unprofessional because I wore my hair in its natural state. I've had natural hair since I was 18, yet the first time I showed up to a job interview after law school without straightening my hair was in 2020, at age 40, and only two reasons influenced my choice. It was the pandemic and the CEO also had natural hair. The chances were slim that I'd be penalized for showing up to work as my true self. And that's why Judge Jackson's decision to have locks speaks volumes to women like me. There's no code switching with locks. You can't just straighten them or hide them for an interview. They are part of who Judge Jackson is and a clear reminder that she is bringing her full, authentic self into any space she enters, including these confirmation hearings. The fact that many Black women feel like they have to hide, tamp down, or minimize a part of themselves to get jobs they're more than qualified for is a depressing truth, and a clear reminder that hair still represents far more than just a style preference. The Crown Act, legislation that bans natural hair discrimination in schools and workplaces, only passed the House recently. Despite absurd questioning, KBJ is more than qualified to serve on this court. She is shifting the dynamic, not just with her lived experience and her career, but in redefining what leadership looks like. I will teach my daughter to celebrate Black women with all types of hairstyles, because our hair is our crown, and we are beautiful in the diversity of hairstyles, whether we choose to relax our hair or rock a blowout, braids, locks, weaves, or afros. With that said, I hope my baby girl will one day understand the significance of Judge Jackson wearing a natural hairstyle in this historic moment. My daughter can grow up knowing that not only is natural hair beautiful and appropriate for a lawyer, in fact, it's a go-to style for a Supreme Court justice. In her speech accepting the nomination, and again during the opening remarks at the confirmation hearings, Judge Jackson spoke of Constance Baker Motley, an important legal changemaker in the civil rights movement. She understood the importance of the Black women before her expanding what is possible despite the exhausting sexism and racism thrown their way. It is my prayer that Ketanji Brown Jackson will be able to create an expanded sense of what is possible for my daughter by being the first, but certainly not the last, Black woman to serve as a Supreme Court Justice. Our next article by Tamiko Brown Nagin is titled Constance Baker Motley, Civil Rights Queen, Paved the Way for Ketanji Brown Jackson. During her confirmation hearings, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court, acknowledged that she stands on the shoulders of the first Black woman to serve as a federal judge, Constance Baker Motley. But what does it mean to stand on the shoulders of Motley and to have been blessed, as Jackson remarked, to come of age after passage of the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964? It means that Motley changed Jackson's life prospects, opening doors and creating educational and employment opportunities previously denied to descendants of the enslaved. Without Constance Baker Motley's path-breaking contributions to American law and society, there would be no Ketanji Brown Jackson as we know her. Motley litigated dozens of cases that upended state-mandated racial segregation in the South, where Jackson grew up. Those discriminatory laws that Motley fought touched every American institution and belied the nation's promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Blacks faced exclusion or discrimination in every sector, on juries and in law enforcement, in healthcare and housing, hotels and restaurants, parks and playgrounds, and in the workplace, schools, and universities. Jim Crow laws stunted the lives of generations of African Americans, preventing them from realizing what Jackson called her God-given potential. Motley's work to end segregation in schools and universities gained her renown as one of the nation's most celebrated civil rights lawyers and transformed the trajectory of Jackson's life. A protege of Thurgood Marshall, the nation's first Black Supreme Court justice, Motley wrote the original complaint in Brown versus the Board of Education. Considered one of the most important cases in American constitutional law, the unanimous 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision found segregated schools unconstitutional. But because of foot-dragging and violent white resistance to school desegregation, it took years of painstaking litigation to ensure compliance with Brown. Motley led this monumental effort, too, desegregating schools in Atlanta, Savannah, New Orleans, Jacksonville, Chattanooga, Nashville, Mobile, Jackson, and Little Rock, among other places. Jackson's ascension to the U.S. Supreme Court will help fulfill the promise of Brown versus the Board of Education. Motley's efforts made it possible for Jackson to attend integrated schools in Miami, where she made friends from all walks of life, excelled as a debater, and prepared academically for a rigorous college education. After Motley desegregated K-12 schools in the South, she turned to segregation in higher education. She litigated and won cases that opened flagship public universities in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina, and Mississippi to African Americans. And these cases shaped the legal and social environment in which educational institutions far outside the South, including Ivy League schools like Harvard, began to admit appreciable numbers of African-American students for the first time. Yet even once academically gifted students like Jackson gained access to historically white institutions, the road could be rocky. During her confirmation hearings, Jackson spoke of moments when she questioned whether she truly belonged at Harvard. She attended the university for both college and law school and ultimately graduated with honors from both. But it took the kindness of a stranger, a Black woman passerby who admonished a distressed Jackson to persevere, to help her remain on course. It was Motley's achievements that paved the way for Jackson to enter Harvard too, and they are all the more remarkable in the context of the extreme challenges Motley herself faced as a student and later as an attorney and judge. Motley was one of only a handful of women at Columbia Law School during World War II, and she was frequently the only woman in the courtroom as she litigated landmark civil rights cases. Motley once endured a hearing before a federal judge in Birmingham that began with his observation, "Well, you're a woman. How could she possibly be in charge?" he wanted to know. Detractors also often explicitly told Motley that she and other African Americans did not belong. During an oral argument before the Florida Supreme Court, a judge cited innate moral, cultural, and IQ differences between African Americans and whites to justify continued segregation at the University of Florida School of Law. And Motley endured disrespect from many of the white male judges and lawyers she squared off against in court. The lawyer who defended segregation at Ole Miss refused to call her Mrs. Motley. In open court, he addressed Motley only indirectly as her or she. Motley persevered. She sought justice and dignity for herself, as well as for her clients, and for all those like Jackson who would follow her. She did this despite threats to her life. In Alabama, men armed with automatic weapons guarded her as she slept. And in Mississippi, Motley was tailed by the state police as her friend Medgar Evers drove her back and forth to the federal courthouse. Motley escaped Mississippi alive, but an assassin murdered Evers just a month after she had left the state for the last time. Motley was also a mother. She worked the long hours required to help win Brown versus the Board of Education while pregnant, and then with a baby boy. In fact, the trailblazing working mom had an uneasy relationship with traditional motherhood. Her son had turned out well, she reflected in the twilight of her life, even though his mother was always working. Her early effort to balance work and family life makes Motley's a story of enduring significance to many American women. That includes Judge Jackson, a mother of two daughters who, in her opening statement, called attention to her struggles as a working mom. "Girls, I know it has not been easy as I have tried to navigate the challenges of juggling my career and motherhood," Jackson said, "and I fully admit that I did not always get the balance right." The parallels between Motley's struggles and Jackson's and the older judge's way-making for the younger one also extend into Jackson's confirmation process. Motley, a standard-bearer of initial efforts to diversify the bench, gained her nomination under conditions not unlike President Biden's announced commitment to appoint a black woman to the nation's highest court. President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who cared deeply about racial equality, expressly sought names of prospective black and female appointees to prestigious federal posts. Motley's name appeared on several such lists. Critics pounced on both presidents, notwithstanding the abysmal representation of people of color and women on the bench, the historic nature of the appointments, and the nominees' exceptional qualifications. Like Jackson's, Motley's confirmation process proved arduous and unfair. The playbook that critics deployed against both women also bear disturbing similarities. Critics have sought to weaponize Judge Jackson's two-year stint as a public defender serving poor clients in much the same way as they used Motley's practice background against her. Detractors lobbied against Motley's nomination to the federal bench on grounds that her accomplishments as a civil rights lawyer made her too political, an inappropriate choice for the bench. And, as in Jackson's hearings, certain senators made particularly outlandish charges. In Motley's case, Senator James Eastland in Mississippi, a wealthy plantation owner who claimed that Brown versus the Board of Education had destroyed the Constitution, held up Motley's nomination for 7 months. Wielding the power of his chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee, Eastland called Motley a communist, a potentially devastating aspersion leveled against advocates of racial equality. Much more potent than the alleged association with critical race theorists that some senators used as a cudgel against Jackson, the communist accusation destroyed lives and careers during the Cold War. But in the end, Eastland's smear tactics did not prevent Motley's historic appointment in 1966. Even after Motley took her seat on the United States District Court, her identity and her career as a lawyer pursuing equity for the oppressed, including criminal defendants, were used against her. Most famously, during a 1975 sex discrimination case filed against a prestigious law firm by several female law school graduates, Motley's race and sex explicitly figured into calls for her to withdraw from the case, which was an early test of the employment provision of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In personal correspondence to the judge and in a formal motion to disqualify Motley, an attorney for the firm argued that she should not preside in the case because, as an African American and a woman, she likely had experienced workplace discrimination and would strongly identify with other women who allege discrimination. "I believe you have a mindset that may tend, without your being aware of it, to influence your judgment." The attorney argued by implication that only white men could properly preside in a discrimination suit. In a brilliant opinion rejecting the motion to recuse, Motley turned the attorney's argument on its face. It is beyond dispute that for much of my legal career, I worked on behalf of blacks who suffered race discrimination, noted Motley. I am a woman, and before being elevated to the bench, was a woman lawyer. However, these facts did not and could not by themselves rise to the level of bias. If background or sex or race of each judge were by definition sufficient grounds for removal, no judge on this court could hear this case, Motley wrote. In the end, the case would open the door to the legal profession for Jackson and millions of American women. Motley was touted for both the Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court, but persistent claims of liberal bias meant she never got the chance. Nevertheless, the soaring opinion by this path-breaking black woman judge defending her right to serve on the bench paved the way for Jackson and so many others who faced challenges based on their identity. That is what it means to stand on Motley's shoulders. Motley did not reach the highest court of the land, but she belongs in the pantheon of great American leaders. It is time for hers to be a household name, invoked in the same breath as Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King Jr. The underappreciation of this fascinating woman in our public histories and popular culture distorts our collective sense of who helped create our more perfect union. Long before the Jackson confirmation hearings, many women lawyers, especially women of color, considered Motley their professional North Star. She was one of just a few women lawyers and the first black woman lawyer known to have appeared at the U.S. Supreme Court, and she won 9 of the 10 cases that she argued there on behalf of civil rights protesters, students, and criminal defendants, among others. It is no wonder that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg called Motley my human rights hero. Kamala Harris, the first woman, the first African American, and the first South Asian vice president, has said that Motley inspired her to fight for the voiceless and for justice. Sherry Lynn Eiffel, the director counsel emerita of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, created the Marshall Motley Scholarship Fund, simultaneously honoring Mr. Civil Rights and the Civil Rights Queen, a leader in her own right. Motley's life should inspire every American. And she paved the way for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first black woman who will make it to the U.S. Supreme Court and break through one of the nation's highest glass ceilings. This moment has been a long time coming. Our next article by Holly George Warren is titled, Can a Feminist Still Love Jack Kerouac? 2022 marks the centenary of Jack Kerouac's birth. I was 16 when I read On the Road, and it changed my life. At the time, in 1973, abortion had just become legal and the pill widely available, but one-year-old Miss Magazine was difficult to find in my North Carolina town. My hippie boyfriend hitchhiked home from Boulder, Colorado, and presented me with his battered paperback of Jack Kerouac's 1957 novel, along with Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen records. I'd never read anything that exhilarated me the way Kerouac's prose did. The following year, I left town for college, did a bit of hitchhiking myself, and eventually landed in New York, where I became a writer and an editor. Kerouac, born 100 years ago on March 12th, was 4 years dead when I devoured the book that turned on a whole generation to a youthful subculture, according to its back cover. The man who coined the term Beat Generation and transformed San Francisco into countercultural ground zero drank himself to death at 47. I learned this and more about the Lowell, Massachusetts-born son of struggling French-Canadian immigrants from my 1973 reading list, Ann Charter's riveting Kerouac, a biography. Charter's was among that first generation of readers, writers, and musicians, including Thomas Pynchon, Sam Shepard, Essie Hinton, Bob Dylan, and Janis Joplin, to name just a few, captivated by Kerouac's cry that the road is life, and inspired by his spontaneous bop-prosody. While researching my 2019 biography of Joplin, I learned that reading Kerouac at age 14 in 1957 precipitated the singer's journey out of conservative Port Arthur, Texas. In 1998, as editor of Rolling Stone's book division and still curious about the beat scene, I conceived the Rolling Stone Book of the Beats. I commissioned essays from Charters and women writers who'd personally known Kerouac, Joyce Johnson, Hetty Jones, and Carolyn Cassidy among them. Johnson, the author of Minor Characters, detailing her relationship with Kerouac from 1957 to 58, wrote in Beat Queens, Woman in Flux, "The Beats have often been accused of having no respect for creative women. But in truth, the lack of respect was so pervasive in American culture in the post-war years that women did not even question it." An accomplished novelist and memoirist, Joyce would later write the illuminating The Voice Is All, The Lonely Victory of Jack Kerouac. For my book of the Beats, her essay contended that she found an unexpected source of encouragement from Kerouac when I showed him the novel I was working on. Upon reading On the Road in 1957, she counted herself among thousands of 50s women who experienced a powerful response to what they read. On the Road was prophecy, bringing the news of the oncoming unstoppable sexual revolution, the revolution that would precede and ultimately pave the way for women's liberation. It suggested that you could choose to be unconventional, choose to experiment, choose to open yourself up to a broad range of experience. 4 decades after my first encounter with On the Road, I'm writing a biography of Kerouac, and I'm grappling with his depictions of women and people of color. When I first read his words as a teenager, I was so transfixed by his promise of every cobbled alley, it didn't even occur to me that the richly textured characters in OTR are all male. Or that Kerouac's empathy for and identification with marginalized people could be offensive to those very people. I identified with protagonist Sal Paradise, an aspiring writer caught up in adventures on the road with the speeding bullet named Dean Moriarty, inspired by Kerouac's friend and muse, Neal Cassady. Today, I recognize the women in the book are mostly one-dimensional objects of the male gaze, either users themselves or to be used by the frenetic adventuring men. But as Joyce Johnson did in 1957, I craved the freedom offered by that emblematic road so mightily, I didn't look outside my own perspective, that of a privileged white girl in a southern town where nonconformity was still shunned. Fellow music journalist and author Amanda Petrouche also re-examined her entanglement with On the Road in a 2018 New Yorker essay, A Slightly Embarrassing Love for Jack Kerouac. I compared notes with her and reached out to other women who fell under Kerouac's spell earlier in their lives. Discovering the book as a brooding and sullen high school freshman, Petrouche reflects today that it seemed like the key to something. I think it's common at that age to be drawn to anything that promises or articulates freedom or ecstasy. I was old enough to want those things, but too young to have them, so instead I lived through books like On the Road. I didn't relate to the women in the book at all, in part because they're hardly women, they're sketches in a way. They never felt truly real or three-dimensional to me. But I can't honestly say that bothered me at the time. It bothered me later. I wish I had been a more enlightened teenager, but that sort of reading didn't happen for me until I was in my late 20s and a little more awake to the way the world bends for white men. Kerouac's work would impact her own career path. His writing was extraordinarily musical, and it certainly shaped the way I think about the rhythm of language, the way a sentence can move, Petrouche affirms. In that way, he was hugely influential for me. He understood that writing could groove. Kerouac is such a beautiful writer, and his life and work hold an undeniable romance, and he meant something to me at a moment in my life in which I was really hungry for someone to show me how to live outside of a certain cultural expectation, how to be an artist, how to be a weirdo, how to wonder, how to want. Writer and adventurer Melissa Holbrook Pearson, author of The Perfect Vehicle, What It Is About Motorcycles, first read OTR at 19 and immediately decided I wanted to be a beat, she says. I read On the Road in the same kind of trance in which it was said to have been written, and I wanted that almost frenetic energy in my own writing. I also swooned at the poetic concision of his prose, as well as his intelligence. God, how he could condense massively complex observations into a single sentence. Kerouac's subject matter also made an impact on Pearson, the author of The Place You Love Is Gone. The notion that the real America resides in seedy, careworn, hidden, unheralded people and places, I think that seeped directly into the heart of our generation. A lot of us, especially in the 1980s, thought there was no way to truly know America unless we hit the back roads. Tasting various regions' different flavors when they still had them required us to light out in search of the original and authentic. I think it was largely Kerouac who instilled the idea in us, suspect the sanctioned, respect the unauthorized. Pearson's views on Kerouac's representation of women have changed over the years, she says. When I was young, I responded to the book as a metaphorical journey and to its heroic voice. I grew up steeped in second-wave feminism, which I professed, but I'd actually internalized cultural misogyny to the point that I held this inchoate idea that the best art was men's. I almost exclusively read men's work and aspired to their genius. Fast forward 30 years to 2021, and I came across the Penguin edition of On the Road, with the eye-opening introduction by Ann Charters, on the giveaway table at my local dump. I'm prone to taking things like this as a sign. It was high time for a reread, and it was suddenly rocky going. The ravenous appetite for experience depicted in the book included the uncaring consumption of women, along with racist tropes. So much of the valorized writing of previous eras contains ideas like these. It's necessary to reckon with this fact without putting everything written before 1990 in the trash. I think any seminal work, one that represents a major cultural pivot, is not only worth reading, though, but necessary to read. Necessary doesn't make it relevant. I think of it as an historical artifact. Journalist Sheila Weller, best-selling author of Girls Like Us, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, and The Journey of a Generation, among other books, discovered Kerouac in the early 1960s. I was a Kerouac fan. I had a bit of a crush on him, she recalls. I loved On the Road. His vibe, passionate but vulnerable, bad boy searcher, all of it was very compelling. His treatment of women, not good. And his friends was worse. Burroughs, hello. But such was the norm in Hitville in those days. Today, it's hard for a feminist to like Kerouac. But through On the Road, we can enjoy his writing, his passion, and his brio, and measure how much we have grown. Actor and writer Amber Tamblyn was dazzled by aspects of the Beats at a young age. But as a founder of hashtag MeToo and the author of Era of Ignition, Coming of Age in a Time of Rage and Revolution, she's had a change of heart. I grew up around artists, writers, and musicians from the Beat generation because my parents are artists who knew many of this, says Tamblyn. Most writers and people I knew in Southern California thought of Kerouac as one of the cool poets, a writer on the edge, both in his work and how he lived. I didn't really look up to his style of writing as much as I looked up to what he represented. He lived a wild life, equal parts destructive and deeply curious, respected and lauded for everything he was, including the worst parts of himself. It wasn't until I got older and became more aware of what my own feminist desires looked like that I realized, as a woman, any admiration I had for Kerouac was through a longing to be as free as he was, to be as selfish and renowned as he was allowed to be, as all of them were allowed to be, without consequence. Most especially during the hashtag MeToo movement, it was increasingly hard to separate the Ginsbergs and Kerouacs from aspects of who they personally were. Their success stories were predicated on predatory behavior that fed into a cycle of abuse. They got away with what they did because they were famous artists who were part of a cultural revolution, and the more they got away with it, the more famous their revolution became. The stars of the Beat generation were white men and white men alone. I can appreciate Kerouac's place in history and what his writing has meant to so many people the world over, but for me personally, I do not hold him among the greats of his generation in that time. Writers such as Jack Hirschman, Diane de Prima, and Amira Baraka. For Kerouac, the personal was not political because it didn't need to be. He didn't need to write out of a place of survival, out of an urgency to expose the injustices around him, of which there were plenty. That's fine, but as a woman who does not have the luxury to do the same, I'll take a writer who writes to save lives any day over a writer and his road. Writer and academic Lena Dawes, author of What Are You Doing Here? A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal, has also moved away from an initial interest in Kerouac. I discovered On the Road in my early 20s during the grunge era, she says. I was probably inspired through other authors I was interested in, and I also read Burroughs, Ginsberg, Hunter Thompson, and my favorite, Hubert Selby Jr. I had tagged along on one of my father's business trips to San Francisco, so I begged him to come with me to the City Lights bookstore, and I purchased On the Road there. She liked Kerouac's freedom, his traveling, and how he wrote about his observations, she says. I wanted to be a writer who could have those experiences. I felt that it was really the only way to be a writer, to travel and see as much as you can to improve your prose. In hindsight, the book screamed of white privilege. I quickly gleaned that as a black woman, I would never feel comfortable doing what he did and probably would encounter a lot of horrible things along the way, as Kerouac's whiteness really protected him a lot and his attitude made him feel superior. Despite the impoverished career as a writer, he never seemed to lose his arrogance. I think his depictions of women and POCs reflected the time the book was written in, but I was semi-dejected that there was a sense of freedom within that book that I felt was only for white men to truly experience. She Feels on the Road should be read by journalism students to critique specifically the gender ethnicity concerns. It is a great example of a certain style of writing and definitely relevant in chronicling that civil rights countercultural generation. But it should be positioned as a study and not a book you should shape your life around. Fiona Patton, Associate Professor of English at the State University of New York at New Paltz, has been teaching classes on Kerouac and the Beats for decades. A native of Scotland, her discovery as a teen of Kerouac's experimental writing in his book Dr. Sacks led her to graduate school in the States, where she earned a PhD at Penn State, writing her dissertation on Kerouac. When I teach Kerouac, I also share with my students some writing from a similar time period, she says, like Henry Miller, Hemingway, Philip Roth, or Norman Mailer. I show them the extent of the chauvinism considered to be normal at that time. My students have grown up in a very different ideological world. When I first discovered Kerouac, I didn't notice the bias, and that was in part because we were just used to reading books by men that privileged the male perspective. We just accepted it as normal, which our students now don't, which is good. But compared to many male authors of that time period, Kerouac is actually a bit more progressive and enlightened. He is capable of insightful social observation in works that people don't read so much, like Visions of Cody. You don't always see it in On the Road, but I also teach The Subterraneans, and confession is really important to Kerouac's ethos as a writer. In that 1958 book, the story of an unself-confident man, at the same time an egomaniac, in Kerouac's words, his protagonist falls in love with a black woman, Mardou Fox. Kerouac lays out all of his own prejudices against women and people of color, says Patton, but he confesses them and says, yeah, I'm an asshole. I find there to be a redemptive quality in Kerouac, that he can do that kind of self-critique. It's really important that students understand him as working through a culture that is all about white privilege. He critiques contemporary popular culture of his time, and it connects to the formation of bias and prejudice. Yes, there's a romanticizing of the other, but it's also quite new and different for a white person to say, I don't want to be white anymore, when American identity was very much defined in terms of the white male. People forget that his perspective then had a radical edge to it that goes beyond just naive romanticism. Among numerous performers influenced by Kerouac are singer-songwriters Michelle Schacht, Mary Gauthier, and Deborah Devi, who each discovered On the Road in their teens and left home. Texan Michelle Schacht, whose 1988 single Anchorage was inspired by a letter from a friend, just as Kerouac's work was sometimes based on his correspondence with Cassidy, did her share of hitchhiking. I read the book when I was 16, she recounts, so it became my gateway to adventure. When you read Kerouac, by the time you put the book down, you were thinking like him, or you're thinking that you're thinking like him. There is a beatific glow, but this would be a very different story if it had been told by a woman. When you go and live that life, the story includes the experience of being raped. Sorry, I'm bringing up an unpleasant truth here, but male privilege has its privileges. If that's what a feminist deconstruction of On the Road looks like, imagine what it looks like to an audience of African Americans. Mary Gauthier's introduction to On the Road coalesced with her coming out as a teenager. It was probably around 1979, 1980, when I was 17, she recounts. I'd quit high school, run away from home, moved in with fellow runaways in Baton Rouge, and started hanging out in the gay clubs. I met a bisexual music-loving guy in the club one night, we became fast friends, and I moved in with him. He was a huge fan of Patti Smith and Jim Morrison, and from there, all roads led to Kerouac. I read On the Road, carried it around as a totem as I moved from place to place. Kerouac's other books led me to Rimbaud, Nietzsche, William Blake, Kafka, Baudelaire, and William Burroughs. The Grammy-nominated artist lived a frantic life until she got sober in her late 20s and became a critically acclaimed songwriter at 35. The impact of Kerouac's writing on my work is more about spirit than style, Gauthier says. His understanding of freedom as a rejection of a mundane life helped shape my own definitions of the word. The fire, the burning, the pushback against conformity, pushing back against the death grip of a life not of my own making, embracing spontaneity, honoring the deep longing inside me, that's the lasting impact. Also, I believe that there are books that burn in your soul when you were a teenager, whose impact lasts a lifetime. On the Road is one of those books for me. That said, now that I'm older, I can better see the sexism, homophobia, and racism in his writing, too. Also, I've rejected the destructive downward pull of addiction, the romance with oblivion associated with Kerouac. These are the forces that killed the man at the young age of 47, yet there is magic in Kerouac's male hero's adventures that I still relate to and probably always will. After Deborah Devi discovered On the Road at 17, it set her on a path to become a blues rock guitarist. I recall feeling both thrilled and disheartened, she says. Thrilled by the wild, bubbling, relentless, nonstop speed prose and the adventurous road trip, yet disheartened because the freedom the male characters reveled in, like my secret dream of playing a guitar in a rock band, was so clearly not for me, a girl. But at 18, my teenage rebellion finally kicked in, sparked by the Subterraneans, which got me dreaming of moving from Wisconsin to Greenwich Village. In a pawn shop, I bought the electric guitar I'd been craving since my early teens. By that time, I decided women could go on the road, too. I moved to New York, joined a band, and did just that, touring all over the U.S., Canada, and Europe. The author of The Language of the Blues, From Alcarib to Zuzu, Devi says her appreciation of Kerouac's immense gifts as a writer has only grown over the years, re-astonishing me whenever I revisit his work. Yet I always found his machismo tiresome, and today also feel sad that he lived and wrote during a time when homosexuality was widely closeted and criminalized. Like Henry Miller, Kerouac often wrote about women as less than human, to be used for male pleasure. Regarding people of color, Kerouac indulged in a pretty embarrassing romanticizing of his Black and Latino characters, laying on them all kinds of magical, sexual, artistic otherness that has not aged well. But Devi still recognizes the value in his work. Kerouac's breakthrough for all artists, in my opinion, was his brave willingness to numb his inner censor and just write as freely and wildly as he could. Every time I play a guitar solo or sing a song, I know I have to do the same thing. I have to turn off the inner censor, get into the divine slipstream, and flow with it. Kerouac's best moments are a glistening snail's trail of that magical experience and an inspiration. Gauthier, the author of 2021's Saved by a Song, The Art and Healing Power of Songwriting, agrees that the power of Kerouac's work persists. On the Road is an inspiration for anyone who feels dissatisfied with the pressures to conform to a conventional lifestyle that is not authentic to them, she says. I imagine the book burners will set flame to it again at some point when it's assigned in a classroom somewhere, a sure sign that the book remains impactful and expansive on the minds of young readers. So how do we as feminists approach Kerouac's work? Clearly, in our artistic lives, many of us, regardless of gender, have been emboldened by his writing. As we understand his flaws, his work still stands as transformational, though the man himself never achieved his own aspirations as a human being. This conversation will continue. Our next article by Dr. Christina Cleveland is titled, My Soul-Soaring Pilgrimage to Visit the Black Madonnas of France. When I walked to Vichy, France, to visit its 12th century Black Madonna, whom I lovingly nicknamed She Who Cherishes Our Hot Mess, I sublimely stood before a sacred walnut wood statue of a holy woman who looked like she could be my mother. Though I was alone in a cavernous, dimly lit church, I instinctively knew I was safe in the presence of the Black Madonna of Vichy, who was especially known for welcoming the needy. As I spoke to her of the internalized shame I carried as a Black woman, I joined a powerful, centuries-long lineage of peasants, African migrants, abused women, and neglected children who traveled by foot across the Auvergne-Chêne-de-Puys volcanic mountain range to speak to her of their need. Her black and female body assured me that she cherished my black and female need as I laid it on her altar. But my journey didn't start in France. As a child in Sunday school, I learned that questioning the goodness of a God who murdered the entire world in a flood would not be tolerated. At home, I learned that asking why Dad was the head of everyone, including Mom, was a punishable offense. As a young adult, I received death threats when I published an article questioning why, despite its historical inaccuracy, we rarely challenge the image of a white Jesus. So I buried my questions deep under the soil of my soul, promising to return to them when it felt safe. There were deeper questions. Why does white patriarchy get to create God in its own image? If God is white and male, then how can a black woman like me ever be truly sacred? Are there any spiritual icons that unapologetically affirm my blackness and femaleness? But as the time passed, I never asked them. To be certain, my experiences invariably led me to more progressive beliefs and action. For example, my experience as an unmarried black woman led me to reject the conservative gender roles my parents handed down to me and adopt more liberal ones within my faith tradition. In this way, I was able to create enough wiggle room to work within the patriarchal religious system. Indeed, I found meaning and joy in my faith-based justice efforts as I advocated for women, for people of color, and for myself. But as the time passed and I moved on to my 30s, I never felt fully free, and the deeper questions remained untouched. The moment I met her, everything changed. It was in the wake of Donald Trump's 2016 election, and I was desperate for a divine being that spoke directly to the pain I carried as a black person and a woman. I was vaguely aware of the Black Madonna, an uncommon dark-skinned version of the Virgin Mary, so I ordered a slew of books on the little-known Catholic figure. To retrieve the shipment, I had just braved a rainy gauntlet between my porch and the cavernous mailbox at the end of my long gravel driveway, and was drying off with a cup of cinnamon cardamom tea in the nest of blankets on my kitchen couch. Before studying the text, I casually flipped to the illustrations of the uncommon dark-skinned version of the Virgin Mary within. Before I even read anything, my soul immediately recognized that these photos and drawings of ancient black Madonnas affirmed my questions about the divine. Questions that first surfaced when I was a young girl and very quickly buried. I learned that there are over 450 black Madonnas around the world, most of whom are over 1,000 years old, with names as illustrious as Our Lady of the Good Death, Slave Mama, and Dear Dark One. Though they are often housed in Catholic churches, many are believed to be modern-day versions of the ancient dark goddesses, such as Isis, Demeter, Sibyl, and Artemis. In fact, the Black Madonnas draw seekers of all religions and creeds and welcome all who need healing and empowerment. The 1,000-year-old Black Madonnas depicted in the books in front of me liberated my questions with the force of a cork popping off a 1,000-year-old bottle of champagne. The late bell hooks experienced a similar freedom when she encountered the Black Madonna. She later lamented, "Unfortunately, African Americans have not been interested in reclaiming representations of Black Madonnas." And this is a sensitive point because most constructions of Black femaleness are tied to representations that are hateful and ugly. So the idea of an icon that can stand in resistance becomes further and further away. The images of a loving and beautiful black female God showed me that my questions are not only valid, but are harmonious echoes of questions heard around the globe and across time. Over the following months, I devoured every book I could find on her. But my soul longed for more than book knowledge. I longed to gaze into her mysterious and kind eyes, to witness her unyielding clutch on her precious black boy, to run my fingers along her centuries-old dark wooden body, and to stand before a sacred image of black femininity. So I embarked on a solo, physically demanding, yet soul-soaring, 5-week walking pilgrimage across Auvergne, a mountainous region in central France. There, I walked over 400 miles to visit 18 black Madonnas and remote village churches. During my pilgrimage, I powerfully experienced that the Black Madonna represents a loving and beautiful black female divine that can absolutely stand in resistance to all the ways that the white patriarchal world had denigrated me. During the French Revolution, insurgents stole and decapitated the Black Madonna of Vichy. However, the oppressed people who loved her tracked her head down, built her a new walnut body, and pieced her back together. When I visited her on my pilgrimage, I knew I could tell her that as a black woman living in a white patriarchal world, I had been decapitated too. I knew I could tell her that even after years of trauma therapy and mindfulness meditation, it still often feels like my body, emotions, and heart are miles away from my overdeveloped, overeducated, overlinear brain. I knew she understood because she, too, had been severed, and she understood that the process of being pieced back together is a sacred weaving that cannot be rushed. Her story of healing was proof to me that my healing does not have a deadline and that every step in any direction belongs. In She Who Cherishes Our Hot Mess, I encountered a God who unapologetically affirms my blackness and my femaleness. In her company, I also experienced unconditional acceptance, what Clarissa Pinkola Estes described when she wrote The Black Madonna in all her representations, is known as the healer of crippledness, the healer of harmed women, hurt men, and injured and abused children. She is mother mild and tender, mother most alert and tending to, mother most fierce and protective, and mother who heals the worst of the wounded. Though bell hooks has joined the ancestors, it's not too late to follow her guidance as black women and reclaim black Madonnas. If we look to the black Madonna, she will show us how she's always been right here welcoming our need, showering us with love, and affirming the sacredness of our black femaleness. Our next article by Sarah Stillman Berger is titled The Secret to Having a Happy Marriage. All that dancing and laughter. Weddings are a lot of fun, but being married isn't always a piece of cake. Sometimes it's more like the frosting chunk that went up your nose during the smash. Good intentions, but wrong outcome. There's actually a lot of work that goes into living happily ever after, so whether you've been married for years or just tied the knot, we ask the experts what couples can do to have a happy marriage. Follow their helpful tips for a stronger, healthier, and yes, more blissful bond. First of all, even happy couples argue. No marriage is happy all of the time. Like all relationships, there are ups and downs, says psychologist Erica McGregor. But when you do fight, happy marriages listen to each other's point of view, recognize when the argument is going off the rails, and make the necessary repairs, she says. In fact, Dr. Juliana Morris, a family and couples therapist, says that some of the happiest couples she has worked with have weathered hard times. So if you and your spouse sometimes argue or are going through a rough patch, this does not necessarily mean you're in an unhappy marriage. In fact, it probably means you're normal. Focus on each other's strengths. It's not always easy to see past minor annoyances, and at times you may even hate your partner. But to have a happy marriage, you have to accept your partner's strengths and weaknesses and be able to set realistic expectations, says Ellen Schute, LMSW. For example, if you're better with numbers, don't get angry when they misbalance the checkbook. Instead, make it your job to set the budget. If their strength is cooking, they can manage meal planning instead. Using our strengths on a daily basis is associated with greater well-being, says Suzanne Pilecki-Poluski, co-author of the book Happy Together, which she wrote with her husband, James Pilecki, PhD. And when we help our partner use their strengths, we experience more relational satisfaction, she says. Don't expect your partner to complete you. Reality check, Jerry Maguire is a movie character. When he announced You Complete Me, it sure was romantic, but it doesn't fly in the real world. According to Pilecki, if you rely on your spouse to fulfill you, it can lead to an over-dependent relationship where you are not growing as individuals. Instead, couples in healthy relationships should complement, not complete one another, she says. We should be secure, mature, and whole in ourselves while being open to the other person. So make sure you nurture your own interests and desires. Take a class you're interested in. Make plans with friends instead of waiting for your spouse to fill in the void. But still do things together and have fun together. While it's important to not fully depend on your partner in order to maintain a happy marriage, it's also necessary to share common experiences. Injecting new activities and interests into your relationship can strengthen the bond, says Pilecki. When couples share a unique passion or learn a skill together, such as taking a cooking class or tennis lessons, they evolve together. According to Morris, happy couples have a zest for life with each other. Whether it's a love of travel, a strong desire to build a family together, or a dedication to a common cause, these experiences enrich their relationship. Choose to be attracted to your spouse. You get to decide if you think your partner is hot. Believe it or not, yes. Attraction to your spouse is a decision that you have the power to make throughout your marriage, says Sunny McMillan, certified life coach, radio host, and author of Unhitched. She recommends practicing attraction thoughts. To do this, she says, focus on the attributes you're most drawn to, like your spouse's great legs or the way they parent your kids. It doesn't have to be physical. The good news is that your spouse doesn't have to be a cover model for you to feel attracted. According to Shute, happy marriages are based on a sense of connection, she says. Physical attraction is far deeper than looks. Laugh with each other. Life is stressful, so it helps if you can find lightness even when you're in the thick of it. Typically, when a couple has humor, it means they have perspective, says Morris, who recommends couples find laughter in both good and bad times. She says that she has noticed that couples in happy marriages have an ease around each other, whether it's through little inside jokes, a silly unexpected text, or even just watching your favorite comedy together. Connecting with your spouse with laughter can increase your bond, she says. Be kind to one another. It's so important to be respectful and understanding of your spouse, says McGregor. If you are critical and judgmental, it usually ends in defensiveness and resentment. So to keep things happy within the marriage, avoid attacking your partner's character when you're upset. For example, she says, don't say, you're such a slob, you never clean up your dishes. Instead, try saying something like, because I made dinner, I'd really appreciate if you could do the dishes tonight. See how much nicer that sounds? Celebrate small, good moments. Most of us know that it's important to be there for our partner during the tough times, says Pulaski. But she says it's just as important to acknowledge the good times, too. She says that good things actually happen more often than bad, but couples often miss those opportunities to connect. So the next time your spouse shares something positive, like a compliment from their boss, immediately stop what you are doing and focus your full attention, she says. Help them savor the moment by asking questions and actively celebrating the good news. In doing so, you'll show gratitude for the happy moments in your marriage. Appreciate each other. When you're with someone all the time, it's easy to take them for granted. But according to McGregor, you should verbally express your appreciation every day. Whether you're calling positive attention to something thoughtful they've done or letting them know something you like about them, we all need to feel appreciated and reinforced for the things we are doing right, says McGregor. For example, if your spouse makes you coffee in the morning, tell them it started your day with a smile. If we don't feel valued, we may become resentful and grow apart. Accept and expect change. Pulaski believes that to be truly happy in marriage, couples must be willing to grow and adapt. Our needs are always changing, people are growing, and relationships evolve, she says. So what we need today may not be what we need years from now, Morris agrees. It's crucial to bend, flex, and pivot with each other in a balanced dance, she says. Because in successful marriages, each person supports the other so that they can grow to become the best person they can be. And that means maturing as individuals and together as a team. Until death do you part. Our next article by Jamie Kern Lima is titled, Build Resilience by Giving What You Need. Many people think of resiliency as bouncing back from traumatic events and using that experience to grow to a higher state of being. While that's certainly true, there's something else to consider. What we give, we get, writes Jamie Kern Lima in her new book, Believe It, How to Go from Underestimated to Unstoppable. If you're feeling lonely, give community to someone else. If you feel like your voice isn't being heard, ask someone else to share their story with you and then fully listen, she advises. In this excerpt, the IT Cosmetics founder explains how the simple strategy has helped her bounce back. I've always believed that when you give an honest compliment to someone else, you change the world for the better in that moment. Because we are all connected to each other, and what we give, we get. When we authentically, it can't be fake or dishonest, it has to be real, uplift another person, we get lifted up ourselves. It's like the golden rule. It's like Newton's third law. Whether or not we see it right away, it's already true. If you want something, the best way to get it is to give it. I've seen this lesson as a common thread woven through great human beings and great leaders, to live life in a way that sees and serves others. Think about it. Almost everyone who has made a great positive impact lives this way. The aunt or grandma in the family who everyone is devastated to lose, the teacher or school janitor who gets that big tearful celebration when they retire, you know the kind, where even past students show up because they lived a life where they truly saw, cared for, and served others. From Oprah showing up day in, day out for her talk show decades after she never needed to work another day in her life, to the bus driver who forgoes retirement because they cherish giving a smile and hello to every passenger each morning, knowing it might be the only one they get that day. When you truly see and hear another human being, it's often the greatest possible gift you can give them and yourself. The same is true in business. As a boss or leader, one of your jobs is to make sure your team feels seen and heard and safe and like they matter. And you have to really mean it. In addition to higher morale and lower turnover on your team, the added benefit is that since you get what you give, you are then even more strongly and authentically seen and heard and valued as a leader. And for something that seems so simple, it's amazing how rare it is, especially inside leadership structures and companies. Giving what you need is such a simple but powerful practice. When you're intentional about it, I found it to be even more powerful. For me, it's been transformative to look up from my super addictive cell phone screen and take a moment to feel the day, to pay attention to whether I'm truly feeling alive and I'm truly seeing and connecting with other human beings. When I'm having a hard day, trying to give joy or acknowledgement to someone else is one of my tools to snap out of it. And often I realize I'm not practicing it enough, and that's why I'm feeling off. The best part is we all have the power to give in this way right now. If you want friendship in your life, be a friend. If you're not feeling beautiful, see the beauty in others and tell them about it. If you're feeling unseen, let someone else know that you notice them. If you don't have as much material possession or wealth as you want, share what you do have with someone in need. Believe in the power of what you have to give. If you want or need something, give it and watch what happens. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.